This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Right, hello New Zealand and welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name's Mark Pacey from the Wairarapa Archive, and today we're going through Chapter 3 of Don Farmer's excellent second book. Chapter 3, Seeking Lolly Seller Katie's Soft Cinder. Anyone in town with a sense at all knew better than to mess with Katie. A woman, yes, she was. A widow, in fact, but she possessed more power in her steely stare than a prize fighter had in his fists. The young Featherston telephone exchange operator, whose turn it was this day to do the shopping for the whole crew, was scared of Katie at the best of times. But the Pioneer Dairy was just across the street from the busy manual exchange, and Katie did have the best selection of comfort food, soft drinks, and sweets in town, so that's where she had to head. Stepping into the shop, she found it deserted, a rare event for this time of day, except for the green parrot perched at the end of the counter. "Mum, Mum," the parrot screeched. Then again, "Mum, Mum, shop." Katie Burt pushed through the door behind the counter and into the shop. "What are you after?" she asked, not exactly bluntly, but not super friendly tone either. The young woman stammered out the first of the very small order she had memorized, Scotch mints. The mints were a firm favorite of the girls in the telephone exchange. They were simply delicious and melted easily in the mouth, leaving a lingering taste. Katie glared at her. "Don't muck me about, young lady, I'm very busy." Bewildered, the woman stared blankly at Katie, then protested her innocence. For a moment or two, Katie looked baffled, and then the penny dropped. "Oh, Scotch mints. I thought you said Scotch mist, that you were trying to be funny." Then she did something she didn't often do. Katie apologized. The young telephone exchange worker had prized open a small chink in Katie's armor, something many people in town, especially cocky kids, had failed to achieve. They soon learned to be on their best behaviour when you stepped off the footpath and through the doors of the Pioneer, or risk a steely gaze and the flat of Katie's tongue. Many a teenage boy filled with bravado had come off second best with Katie, entering the shop a hero of his peers and emerging a wounded lamb. The parrot Katie adored often came to the party too. The bird was a draw card for customers and a great watchdog for his owner. If Katie was busy or out the back preparing the beautiful array of takeaway food, especially cakes, she was renowned for, the parrot would switch on duty mode. "Put that down," the bird would screech at anyone manhandling the stock. As a widow, Katie, running a busy shop on her own, with little help from her best friend Biddy Kerr, realised she had to be tough and in charge at all times. Her taxi driver husband, Bill, had died before the Pioneer was built. Katie had been in business just a stone's throw away from a much smaller shop, on a much smaller scale, but had taken on the brave decision to expand and have a real crack as a shop owner. The people of the town admired the feisty widow for having the pluck to do it, and had to admit the Pioneer was the jewel in the crown of the shopping area. It was not only a shop, but Katie's home, with a very modern living quarters and a big back section. In the lounge, Katie had wooden shelving inbuilt along the entire wall, a huge bookcase to cater for her passion for reading and book collecting. It was her love of reading that gave a young married man living close by the break he needed to get in Katie's good books and prize a chink in the widow's armour wide open, but not before an embarrassing Sunday afternoon encounter. The newlywed had been dozing in the lounge of the flat he rented immediately behind Dave Shepherd's real estate business when his wife decided to have some fun. As he slept, she used face paint to draw a pair of glasses around his eyes, a fake moustache, and a healthy crop of cat-like long whiskers. Not content with just that, she carefully attached several hair clips and two pink ribbons to his hair, and, for good measure, opened the fly of his shorts, thinking he would awake, discover what had been done to him, and share the joke. With that, she went about her work in the kitchen at the rear of the flat. Waking, her husband decided to slip next door and buy a couple of ice creams. He opened the front door, walked along the wooden boardwalk, turned right, and went the few extra steps into the dairy. Katie and Biddy were behind the counter, just chatting and facing the front door. Both took a double take and then burst out into laughter, totally blindsiding their only customer, who was soon to discover what had amused them, and beat a retreat with the laughter ringing in his ears. The incident melted the ice with Katie, and soon she smiled and chatted away whenever the man entered the shop. Katie thawed out to the stage where she revealed she had a well-hidden, but rather risque, sense of humour. As Biddy listened, she would tell of two young men who walked a young girl who worked in the tea rooms making sandwiches home one night. The girl lived with her widowed mother, and some boys secretly hoped she would extend them some special favours. That was not to be, although an offer was made. When we got to the gate, she said she wouldn't let us, but Ma might. Oh, I love the humour. The two women would chuckle away. Heaven only knew how many times Biddy had heard that tale. Katie became even friendlier when she learned that her neighbour loved books. One day she surprised him by inviting him into her home, offering to lend him a book as long as he returned it in tip-top condition. With that, she took a book titled Coral Sea Calling, written by one of her favourite authors, Ion Idris, I hope I pronounced that right, and handed it over. For Katie, that was a major concession to make. Soon she was the proverbial lending library for the man, with dozens of books being drip-fed to him, along with the occasional bag of lemons or grapefruit Katie had picked for the couple from the citrus trees growing in her backyard. They had found Katie's soft centre. As it turned out, they weren't the only ones. Here and there throughout Featherston, stories emerged of the feisty widow's softer side and her ability to be generous, if she believed it was earned. Young Marion Price had started a small one-woman business from her family home in Underhill Road as a dressmaker and mender of clothing. A forestry worker, one of a team from Rotorua working close by, had torn his work trousers. Not knowing help was so close to hand, he casually mentioned his trouser plight to Katie as he was buying morning tea for the crew. Marion Price will fix them for you. She lives right next door to where you were staying, Katie told him. The job done, Marion was soon approached by another of the team. This fellow had ripped his denim work shorts and needed urgent repairs. Marion decided to have a laugh. She fixed the shorts all right, patching them up with real girly floral material and, for good measure, fringed each of the leg holes with frilly pink lace. As a precaution, the shorts were mended in such a way that the offending material could easily be removed if the burly forestry worker didn't see the funny side. But Marion need not have worried. Her workmanship was a smash hit. Not only did the worker insist on wearing his frilly shorts into the pioneer to show Katie just what her advice on getting a mender had led to, he bought Marion a big box of chocolates in appreciation. Katie had enjoyed the joke too, and when Marion was to have her first baby, she phoned, telling the new mother to call into the shop when she was next in town. There she gave Marion a package of gifts, which included a pink baby toilet seat in memory of the frilly forester's shorts. Marion too had found Katie's soft centre. Katie had the best shop in the best spot and a head for business, an attribute she needed to survive. In her day, Featherston was a bustling little town, crawling with places to eat or buy food. Competition was everywhere. It started at the very entrance to Featherston in the south, with the Summit Tea Rooms, perched at the top of the Remataka Hill Road, and continued right through to the dairy opposite the Tin Hut at Tauheraniko. Directly opposite Katie's shop was a dairy run by the Hercock family, and within a block were two others, the Kia Ora Dairy and Phipps Milk Bar, both strategically placed to capture travellers coming from over the hill. Not far away on Revan Street was the Signal Box Dairy, well positioned for business, with Featherston School just across the street. And to the north on Fox Street was the dinky little lunch bar run by Dickie Holland. Dickie, a slight man, with a rather high-pitched voice, was a master when it came to making cakes and sponges, and he had a limited but very popular eat-in lunch menu. His speciality was his curried sausages. Dickie had the X factor when it came to that dish, and his helper in the business, Noreen Burt, who waited the tables, was just as competent when it came to cooking as her boss. The two could not be more different in stature, with Dickie's slightness being complemented by Noreen's short, stocky appearance, but they worked well in unison and got the market share. Added to the mix was the plethora of grocery shops, greengrocers, a fish and chip shop, and two butcheries. Featherston people were spoiled for choice. Jobs were easy to come by too. It was the days before the computerisation and local body amalgamation. Highly mechanised industry had not taken hold. Workplaces were labour-intensive, and the concept of companies moving offshore for financial gain was virtually unknown. Featherston was a hive of activity. During the working week, its static population meant that the same people were seen in the same places day in, day out. Their personalities and eccentricities were known to all. Well, I think we're about halfway through. I'll just double check. Or maybe not. Maybe I'll read a bit more. We'll read a bit more, then we'll take a break and play some music. Charlie Horton was one whose reputation preceded him. A dapper man who couldn't have weighed more than 9 stone wringing wet, Charlie had a notorious sense of humour. He loved the company of others, and his work in the Featherston Telephone Exchange before his retirement had suited him down to the ground. It was a busy manual exchange, with the day and night being broken into shifts, and the operators working in close proximity to one another. Being part of the main post office building, the exchange could be accessed directly from an outside door or by staff entering through the mailroom. As they bustled through the mailroom on any given day, exchange operators would likely have to dodge post and telegraph linesmen like Barry Hart, the strongman duo of Rex Allen and Joe Ward, or the faultman Alan Cooper on missions from their P&T depot just down the road. Elsewhere in the room would be the mail sorters, clerical staff who answered to disciplinarian Bob Barber, and the rural mail contractors. Popular tennis-loving John Ritchie delivered to homes and farms on RD1 in the morning and RD3 at Western Lakeway in the afternoon. Frank Stewart's driver, Lyle Hislop, took care of the sprawling RD2 contract, which in part covered Pitanoa and the coastal regions of the district. Town postie Margaret Collins sorted mail into order by streets and house numbers, securing the bundles with thick rubber bands ready to pop into the heavy leather bag attached to the handlebars of her bicycle, leaning up against a wall nearby. While Biddy Clark sat in a wee area of her own, receiving and dispatching telegrams. At times it was like standing on the platform at Wellington Railway Station at rush hour. There was a homegrown quality to the exchange, and the operators got to know off by heart the phone numbers of practically everyone in town. They also got to know the movements or whereabouts of many townsfolk at any given time of the day. Dave Flynn, who managed the Cozy Theatre for Kerridge Odeon? Yeah, that's right. And was later to become the Mayor of Featherston, was standing on the footpath outside the theatre one Sunday morning, yawning with a friend, when he heard his name being bellowed out from some distance away. An exchange worker had fielded a call for him, but got no reply from the theatre, and had spied Dave through a window. "Dave, get back in the theatre and answer your phone. Head office in Auckland wants to talk to you," echoed along the pavement. Not only was the exchange usually busy, but it could also be stressful, particularly as not all callers extended the hand of friendship or patiently awaited the operator's attention. Supervisors had to field complaints and keep harmony on board. Something helped enormously by the sharing of stories and anecdotes, and that's where Charlie Horton was invaluable. His fellow workers marvelled at the fact that Charlie, when on a roll, could keep jokes coming for hours without repeating himself. He could tell a tall story with such a straight face it was near impossible to sort fact from fiction. And in hindsight, he missed his calling. He should have been on stage. Right, I think we're well over halfway now. Yes, we are. So I'll play a piece of music now. This is, like these are all the other ones, completely unrelated to the stories. I just play something that I'm liking at the time. This one is a tribute to Nico McBrain. Now, he was the drummer for Iron Maiden from 1982 up until, I believe, last night or the night before. He's decided to retire from touring. He had a stroke last year, managed to recover, but he's 72, so he doesn't want to be on tour drumming with Iron Maiden anymore. And I'll play this particular song. This is Where Eagles Dare. If you listen to the type of drumming that he does, you'll understand why he may not want to do that when he's 72. And just for the drummers out there, the intro is played with a single kick, no double kick. It's quite impressive. So here is Iron Maiden, When Eagles Dare. And that was Eagles Dare. Oh, Where Eagles Dare. Sorry, say it right. So that is the sort of skill of Mr. Nico McBrain. And yes, his surname really is McBrain. I thought that was brilliant because the first name is obviously a nickname. Well, the second one was too. But no, that's his actual name is McBrain. Fantastic drummer. So, you know, we wish him well in his retirement. He's retiring from touring, but not from the band. So if they do another album, he'll possibly play on that. Right on with our story now. We were talking about Charlie Horton. Among his many attributes was his ability to mimic animal noises, especially growling or yelping dogs, and to this he put to good effect. Spying on someone he knew well, walking ahead of him, Charlie would sneak up behind them, and cupping a hand to resemble the mouth of a dog, he would grab the calf of their leg while letting out a yelp identical to whatever breed of dog, be it Doberman, Bull Terrier or Pekingese, took his fancy, frightening the living daylights out of them. Retiring from the telephone exchange, Charlie joined the staff of the New Zealand Farmers Cooperative Distributing Company, or FCDC for short, a stock and station firm whose head office was in Fielding, with branch offices in Masterton and Featherston. The Featherston branch was catered... No, it didn't. The Featherston branch catered for the needs of farmers throughout South Wairarapa. There was also a fully stocked hardware and kitchenware department, and that's where Charlie went to work, transferring his wicked sense of humour to his new workplace. The perennial dog bites leg prank was pulled from time to time on staff and customers, but there was a much wider selection of comic antics he called on. Charlie especially enjoyed winding up his retail department co-worker, Mary Duckett, who he would tease relentlessly and try by whatever means he could to startle her. Mary would scold him, "For God's sake, Charlie, you could have killed me." The two office women, Betty McArdle and Pat Williams, the truck drivers who delivered to the farmers and the storemen working out the back didn't escape either. Charlie would carry a piece of old cotton bedsheet in the pocket of his dust coat and bide his time to put it to good effect. Men loading a truck would stoop to pick up a heavy item, only to hear a violent tearing sound behind them. Convinced they had torn their backside out of their trousers, they would arise to discover the truth. Charlie was at work again. The FCDC was a fairly big employer for a small town. Aside from those who worked in the building, there were men out in the field. Gordon Shirkley and Barry Furlong canvassed the district, drumming up business for the firm, as did stock agent Trevor Loomis and branch manager Ron Hughes, who was always flat out. Ron would be clinching deals left, right and centre. He tackled big deals and minor ones with equal gusto. At his desk, Ron would be heavily engaged signing off on major purchase agreements for a ripening grain crop or a stock purchase, only to look up and see Charlie, Mary and part-time shop assistant Rex Teto under the pump in the shop. Halting to keep the customers waiting. No, that's not right. That's the complete opposite of what I wanted to say. Hating to keep the customers waiting, Ron would stride out onto the floor and serve whoever was waiting, a tradesman, housewife or child. He was just as happy clinching a $2 sale of a cup and saucer as he was selling a truckload of posts and strainers. Ron was not one for small talk on the shop floor, though, unless it was about rugby, a sport he loved, and not to be confused in the slightest with rugby league. The 13-man game got Ron bristling. He looked upon it as an invasion of the territory of real rugby. On Birdwood Street, the town's biggest employer, Batavian Rubber Company, had a payroll far in excess of the FCDC. The firm employed men and women from throughout South Wairarapa, making, as the name suggests, practically everything that involved rubber. Gloves were a major part of the business, not only day-to-day gloves, but specialist gloves for the medical profession and the heavy industry. The glove department was nestled alongside the balloon manufacturing area, where an incredible number of balloons were made each day and every working day. Elsewhere in the factory, other rubber items were manufactured for both big and small, including teats for babies' bottles. Out the back of the older section of the business, women were flat out cleaning and packing up bathing caps and Lilo airbeds for distribution to clients. Batavian had started out on the other side of the Remataka Hill, but the need to expand became obvious. The property in Featherston was purchased. Company director Karel Nietzsche, who was always known as Carl Nies, was a shrewd businessman who ran a tight ship. In the days when everything was done manually, the work was demanding. It was a fast-paced business with plenty of noise and environment, and the need to keep your wits about you was paramount. The pay was not as good as could be earned by travelling over the hill to Petone or Lower Hutt to work in the car assembly factories or cigarette manufacturing plants, but for Wairarapa Upper it was better than most, apart from seasonal work at Waingawa Freezing Works. Rubber workers had to clock in and out each day, and tea breaks and lunch stops were timed to the minute. Production was the catch cry. Carl Nies, while a demanding boss, could be a surprise package. As a rule of thumb at the factory was that any worker who was to call in sick had to make it known to the office and staff quite a while prior to the working day beginning or risk being dismissed. A young worker in the balloon department, whose job was to dip the racks of balloons that came out of the ovens into the bath of French chalk before sliding the moulds onto the rails for women to strip the balloons, found himself in a dilemma one morning. He awoke far too late to meet the sick call deadline, only 5 minutes before the factory was to burst into life. Knowing he would likely lose his job anyway, he went AWOL, deciding to take what was coming to him. Then he made a fatal mistake. He strolled into the town centre in mid-morning, only to come face to face with Carl, who had been at the post office collecting the mail from the company's private box. "Why aren't you at work?" Carl scowled him. He told the truth. "I woke up too late to phone in, so I took the day off." The next morning, having heard nothing further, the young worker nervously walked to work, thinking he would be heading home within minutes of his last pay in hand. But nothing happened. He started work and carried on up until near knock-off time, when suddenly Carl appeared in the balloon department. He called the department staff to order. "I want you all to gather round. I have a presentation to make," he said. Then, without giving the game away even slightly, Carl produced a gift-wrapped box from behind his back and handed it to the errant young worker. "Open it," he instructed. With mounting trepidation, the young man undid the ribbons and tore off the gift wrapping to find a new, top-of-the-range alarm clock inside. Carl smirked. "Now you have no excuse for not coming to work," he said, and walked off as the young man's fellow workers broke out laughing. Now, are we done? I think we're done. Or are we done? Hang on, just making sure I'm doing this right. No, I think that's it. Yes, it is. How are we for time? Oh, we're exactly on time. So have a brilliant week. According to a little alert that came up on my computer just a little while ago that's now disappeared, it's saying that tomorrow we're going to have hot weather near record temperatures, whatever that means. So it's probably going to be a very hot one. So if you're going outside, please cover up. We will see you in a week. I've got a few more shows left this year. I'm not taking time off, I think, until the 24th is my last day. So I will be back next week and probably the week after that. We'll continue reading Don's excellent book. We'll find some other interesting piece of music that we can play for you. So have a brilliant week, and we will see you in 7 days.